Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com, yourfinancialchoices.com. You can listen online every week at wdiy.org. You can stream live with us, especially for our listeners outside of our local listening area. And if you are a regular listener, of course, you can mention to friends. WDIY.org is also available online. I had some folks I was talking to in Illinois the other day, and they said they still listen regularly. So that was good to hear, even though they moved out of the area. The markets, let me mention, it is March 1st, 2017. The markets were up today, the Dow closing at 21,115, the NASDAQ at 5904, and the S&P at 2395. As many of you know, it is tax time. It's kind of my favorite time of year. And I have to tell you, it's because I have to be so focused this time of year. I know what I'm doing every day. I'm actually a creative person by nature, even though I am a CPA. Sometimes those terms don't always go together. And I'm not creative with people's taxes. Let me just make that clear. I'm a very careful tax preparer. But the creativity sometimes sets me off in a number of different directions, like balls on a billiard table when you hit that cue ball, kind of go off in many directions. But so it's kind of nice during tax season because I'm very focused and know what I'm doing every minute of the day, which is doing tax returns, which is what I hope you listeners are doing or have already done or will be planning to do, which is filing your tax returns, getting those returns done and prepared timely, especially when you may owe or get a refund. So here's what I like to propose for people to, prepare your tax return, get an idea of what your numbers look like. Because if you owe, the payment isn't due actually this year until April 18th. But at least if you have an idea of what it is now, you can save. You can save a little bit of your paycheck or your discretionary spending so that you have enough money to pay that tax come April 18th. But if you have a refund, you want to get that tax return filed so that you can get that refund quicker. And especially if you electronically file, which is definitely the way most people go these days, with electronic filing, you can have it directly deposited into your bank account. And it goes very quickly. So we like folks to get started on those tax returns as soon as you can. Tonight, what is my topic? My topic is listeners' questions. And in particular, listeners' tax questions, because I figured it is that time of year. And folks, I have nothing else planned for the show tonight. So I'm going to have Jeff play music if we don't get some listeners' questions. And Jeff's got some good music. So if you have questions, I would love to hear them. And to make it convenient for you, you can either call live on air and talk with me or off air. If you're not comfortable talking live on air, maybe you don't want anyone to know or recognize your voice when you ask that question about your $500,000 tax return or something like that. You can give your question to Lori C. She's in the studio answering the calls. She'll write the question down and she'll bring it into the studio and I'll do my best to answer it. That's if it's off air. But if you're comfortable talking live on air, I'm happy to do that as well. It's the most fun for me. So at this point, I will tell you the show is live. It's live tonight, and we will take your questions. And we just ask you, if you do call in live, to mute your radio so that we can talk without the delay, which confuses people somewhat. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I do typically have a topic each week, you can always ask questions off topic as well. The number, get your pencil ready, 610-758-8810. 610-758-8810. And of course, sometimes questions are a little bit more complicated or convoluted. You're welcome to send questions through the website, yourfinancialchoices.com as well. Well, you know, I am someone who prepares. So even though I said the only thing I have going tonight are listeners' questions, I did happen to write down a bunch of questions that came in to me today in email. So I had several questions that came through, some from the same person, but I thought they were still good questions. And if, you know, one person has it, chances are more than one person will have the same question. So One couple that I talked to earlier in the day had asked me, they said they had read an article or got maybe a brochure or something in the mail talking about transferring their home to their child tax-free. So in essence, can you transfer your home to your children tax-free? And they said that there were a number of different methods. And what did I think about that? Well, interestingly, there are so many facets to that question that it is a more convoluted answer than you might expect. Number one, when someone says, oh, we could transfer our house to our kids tax-free, what does that mean? Why would they think there was some kind of a tax event to begin with? And if they think there's some kind of tax event, what kind of tax do they think they're talking about? Are we talking about inheritance tax, estate tax, or income tax? So I'm going to have more on that in just a minute, but I see that I have a caller. We have Mark from Douglasville. Mark, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. How can I help you?
Yeah, hi. So I did my taxes recently myself, you know, for TurboTax, and came to find that my wife and I owed several thousand dollars in taxes, and which we never have before. And a lot of it is because my wife took a new job in the last year, and I have a relatively new job too. But we came to realize that we had too many withholdings, I guess, in our W-4s.
Yeah.
And I believe we're both filing married and with one deduction there or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've corrected them. I just want to make sure that we've probably done the right thing with what we selected for our W-4 correction. So I changed mine to filing married but with zero withholding,
mm-hmm.
and she changed herself to single with zero withholding so we could kind of catch up a little bit.
Yeah.
Because we did this, I think, toward the end of January, beginning of February.
Mm-hmm. Mark, that's great, and it's a great point, and it's a great question, and let me point something out. So what happens when we work at a job, our employer goes to a table which tells them what to withhold, and a lot of people don't realize this. The employer knows nothing about our spouses or any other money we have on our tax return. They just say, you're making this much either weekly or monthly or biweekly or however, whatever the pay period is. They go to the IRS table, employer withholding tables, and they just withhold whatever amount it is that you've indicated on your W-4, which could be married, filing married, but withholding at the higher single rate, and then
right.
How many exemptions we have. So if you both, in my little story here, if you both did married, filing, joint, and zero, you may or may not be okay. If you did both, as your wife is doing single, what's going to happen is they are going to withhold a little bit more from her. What people don't realize is when you add your income together, it throws you into completely different brackets. If I could give a really simple example, let's pretend, and don't tell me anything that you make, but let's pretend you make $70,000 and your wife makes $70,000. Well, a $70,000 married filing joint person might have very, you know, minimal withholdings or lower withholdings than someone married filing joint making $140,000. Now you're talking about the 25% tax bracket versus the 15% bracket. So right. even with your wife switching to single, which I think was a good idea, depending on how much she makes, it still may not be enough. So here's what you do. You put on your calendar for the first week of October to get your pay stubs. You and your wife take your pay stub. You have TurboTax. You should be able to go back into TurboTax and do, there's usually a planning feature in there where you can right. project. And you go ahead and enter what your wages are for, annualize them. So you know what your pay is through the end of September. Then say, okay, we have this many pay periods left. This is what our withholdings will be through the end of the year. Do that on a little piece of paper. Put those numbers in TurboTax and see if you're covered. If you're not covered, you can go back to your employers and have them withhold an additional amount. So you take that W-4, you're married filing joint with zero, you can say take an extra $50 or an extra $100 or an extra $200. And then hopefully that'll work to make sure you're covered.
Okay.
Okay. So good luck with that. But I think it's good that you looked at it and that you caught it and you're doing something about it. So make sure you mark your calendar. It's actually kind of fun to do and watch out for. And then to the extent you have employer plans you may be eligible for, you could also increase your contributions to those, and that would also lower your income. And lower.
Yeah, that's something else. That's something else I'm going to be doing shortly. But yeah, I didn't know about that checking in October. I'll try doing that.
Yep, good job. Okay, thanks, Mark. Right. Thanks for calling. Have a good one. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY is throwing a party, and you're invited. Join us for a night of live music, food, drinks, and fun as we celebrate WDIY's 22nd anniversary, featuring a performance from Steve Broski and his Big Little Band, Saturday, March 4th at the Ice House in Bethlehem. Get your tickets today at WDIY.org. We'll see you there.
Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. This is your host, Lori Siebert, and we are taking listeners' questions tonight. The phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. In particular, because it's tax time, I thought it would be a nice opportunity for folks, if they have questions about taxes, to give me a call to see if we can help kind of move things along. Mark just called with a great question. I love that. And I love that people are paying attention. And sometimes people don't realize the impact of those W-4 withholdings, especially since a lot of times we get our pay stubs now electronically. Back in the day, we used to get them paper and you could kind of look at it and keep track as you're going along. Now we do it electronically. And who really looks at those? I mean, does anybody go online and look at their pay stubs? I don't, but you know, that's me. Cobbler's children don't have shoes. So anyway, you can look at your pay stub. Sometimes it's on the W-2 where it'll show your filing status and if it's married, filing joint, and how many exemptions. I did just have another client who had done something similarly. He had married, filing joint, and 5 exemptions. And where he got caught up was, he not only had wages, they had significant investment income. And I'm talking like significant investment income. So you can control your tax withholdings a little bit to also help cover the tax due on the other income you have besides wages. So if you have high interest and dividends, you can adjust withholdings. And a lot of people don't realize that you can have withholdings on your Social Security. There are people who just live on Social Security and that's all they have. Well, then chances are that income's not going to be taxable. But if you're someone who's retired, you might be getting a pension, you might have some investment income, you might be taking IRA distributions, chances are your Social Security might be taxable then, up to 85% includable in your page one income. And in that case, your other withholdings may not be enough to cover the tax due. Some people will make quarterly estimated tax payments. That's all well and good if you're disciplined enough to remember to make those checks quarterly, some folks don't want to be bothered with that or mess it up. So they can increase their withholdings either on their pensions, their IRA distributions, or Social Security. So again, a lot of people don't realize you can have federal withholdings on Social Security. You can have federal withholdings on pensions, on annuities. You want to pay attention to that depending on the source of income and what other income you have, whether or not you need to do withholdings. The wonderful thing about withholdings versus quarterly payments is the withholdings are deemed to be made evenly throughout the year. The IRS, it's a pay-as-you-go system, and they expect you to pay your taxes as you go along. And if you don't, you could end up having some penalties. Quarterly payments aren't deemed necessarily, you know, as even as those withholdings if you have to make some kind of a catch-up on those. All right. We have a call on line one. We have John from Allentown. Hi, John. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Lori. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Not bad. Not bad. Happily waiting the arrival of my return.
Yay.
I should get some cash back. And I sent it out about 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, Lori.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering about how long will Uncle Sam take to send me my money?
Well, you said you sent it out, John. Did you mail a paper copy or did you send it electronically?
Oh, yeah. I sent it Pony Express out of the Emmaus Post Office.
Oh, Pony Express is going to take longer, John. And a second question, if you have a refund coming, did you have it directly deposited or did you say no direct deposit, send me a check?
Yes, I put the check number and all
okay.
that other stuff
for
on
for direct deposit. Well, that will
yes,
help.
Ma'am.
That will help that go a little bit faster. If you mail in the return, it will take a little longer. And to tell you the truth, off the top of my head, I don't know how long that would take. I would guess at least 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay.
When you file it electronically, I mean, it could be 2 to 4 weeks. I will
okay.
mention, though, that there was some bit of a delay in some refunds where there were people who were, and don't tell me if you filed for any of this, but where people were filing for things like earned income tax credits or American Opportunity credits, certain refundable refunds, the IRS was holding up the release of refunds on certain returns just
okay.
so that they could verify.
I basically I did a long form, pretty straightforward stuff, and I had extra money each check withheld, so I wouldn't have to pay this year, and I went from I have a healthy return coming. It was like kind of a hidden savings for
That's
me.
Great. That's great. And, you know, it's so funny because I know people will say to me, Lori, I know you're CPA and I know you think it's silly that people have refunds, but I kind of like the refunds. And I say, it's not silly at all. There is sometimes a forced savings for people. And you know what I say? Whatever works. And it's kind of like a bonus. I have people who tell me they use it for their real estate tax payments. So whatever works. But yeah, I would say at least probably 4 to 6 weeks only because you paper filed.
Okay. All right. 4 to 6. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, the other part, too, is it's like people that are so incensed about even if it's $1,000 or $2,000, unless you're really lucky on an investment, you're not really going to make any money over the course of a year.
Mm.
And you only have the tax that you're, you know, they're only holding the
right.
money.
Right,
at
I see what you're saying.
The longest period of time,
right.
it's going to be 11 months.
Right, right, yeah, yeah. Whether the bank has it or you have the IRS
or,
has
or
it.
Or you could even if you put it in some kind of fancy investment profile,
mm-hmm.
unless you get like, some kind of crazy thing that, you're really not going to make any real money.
Right, right. John, I have another break in about a minute. Did you have another question, too?
Yes, mm-hmm. capital gains.
Mm-hmm.
I have some stock, and I'm planning to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long-term hold.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like 3 years that I've had
okay.
this stock. So I'm wondering, what do I have to do to declare the gain?
Well, what will happen is if you sell it through a broker, if you have it at a particular firm, or you may have it just with a transfer agent, you know, like Computershare or something like that.
Well, I have like an E-Trade kind of account.
Okay. They'll issue a 1099-B, B as in boy, to you. And if you bought it through E-Trade 3 years ago, they will have the cost basis on that, and they will report that to the IRS as well. So,
what do you mean? How do you define the cost basis?
Whatever you bought it for. And if you did dividend reinvestments, the dividends also add to the cost basis.
Okay, so that means my gain over the time.
Well, so pretend you bought a mutual fund or a particular stock and you invested $5,000 and now it's worth $6,000 and you go to sell it. The E-Trade, whatever the custodian is, will issue a 1099-B saying, here's the date you bought it, here's the date you sold it, here are the proceeds, $6,000, here's the cost basis, $5,000, here's your gain, $1,000. And then you'll take that information and report it on Schedule D, D as in David, on your tax return in the year that you sell it. And that information is also getting reported to the IRS as well.
So, okay. All right, and I'm also planning to sell a house.
Okay.
It's my primary residence, and I've been here 17 uh-huh. years now.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, it's I paid it off, and so how does that affect my tax liability?
Okay.
Just concerning or affecting the federal people, the IRS.
Well, if you sell a house that's been your principal residence that you owned and occupied for two out of the last 5 years, if you're single, there is a $250,000 exclusion. So if your gain is not more than $250,000, there's really nothing to report. That gain is tax-free. If you're married filing joint, it's a $500,000 exclusion. So you should be good. And typically they might still give you a 1099-S to report the proceeds if you sell it for more than $250,000 and you're single. But if you're selling it for under $250,000 and you know the gain's less than $250,000, there would probably be nothing to report. They won't even issue a 1099-S.
Oh, really?
Yep. Okay.
Okay.
Nothing to report for Fed or state.
All right. Okay.
Great, John. I've got to take my break, hon. So
Lori, thank you very much.
You're
Lori,
welcome.
Have a good night.
You too. Thanks, folks. If you have questions, phone number is 610-758-8810. And when we come back, I will answer Steve's question. Thanks.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station.
Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. We're taking listeners' tax questions tonight. The phone number is 610-758-8810. We had a question come in from Steve. He asked, we have a notice of taxes due for 2015. It's a substantial amount. The deadline for appeal is March 6th. Should I just pay it and contest it later? Because I want to avoid any further penalties. Well, Steve, the first item to note is when you say it is going to appeal or you have a chance to appeal, that indicates to me that this may not be the first notice you would have received regarding the taxes due for 2015. Generally, the IRS will send one notice, maybe a follow-up notice, and then the third notice might be saying, hey, this is it, you know, last chance, you know, this is what it's going to be. So I'm wondering if you didn't respond to maybe an initial notice. The second thing I want to mention is I never necessarily take it for fact the IRS notices. It may not be right at all. The IRS is relying on information that has been reported to them from entities like your employer or a custodian. What I'm wondering might have happened is if there was some income that was reported to the IRS that perhaps you did not reflect on your return, but it could be something that could be not taxable or some other problem, you really need to investigate it. Let me tell you a story. I had a gentleman come 10 years ago, and he owed a ton of money. He got a notice from the IRS, owed a ton, like several thousand dollars. Very upset. He was going to pay it. I looked at the notice, and what we discovered is that what the IRS was saying was income that wasn't reported on his return ended up being sales of stock that he had sold. He didn't think he had to report them because he had a loss on it, and he didn't want to bother reporting that loss. You know, it was just too much trouble for him. He, you know, prepared his own tax return. And I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but let's pretend the sale proceeds were $100,000. Well, back then, several years ago, the custodians didn't report the cost basis to the IRS. No one tracked that. So the only information that the IRS had was this $100,000 of sale proceeds. They didn't have any information on the cost basis. So once we looked at the cost basis, and in my story, I'll say the sale proceeds were $100,000 and the cost basis was $120,000. This person didn't have a $100,000 gain. They had a $20,000 loss. When we amended the tax return, that's what we did to respond to the notice. We amended the tax return, said, hey, IRS, taxpayer inadvertently omitted the reporting of these sales, expecting that there was a loss and they didn't need to. Please accept this amended return, you know, that we are providing now. Sure enough, all of us accepted, no tax due. And in fact, the client had a capital loss that they got to carry forward indefinitely. So that's one example of something that might have happened. Another example might be that you did just make a mistake, but you want to make sure that you understand that it is accurate. So don't necessarily take what they say as the end all be all. You want to do your homework. And generally, by the way, in that notice that they send you, they should detail where the numbers are different. So they should send a notice saying, here are your numbers, here are our numbers, and here are the line items that were different. So you should have some detail. If you don't have that detail, and maybe it is one of these notices that's like the last chance and everything, if you don't have a notice that has that detail, march yourself over to the IRS office. I still think there might be one here in Bethlehem. I'm not sure. March yourself over to that office and ask them for that detail behind the differences that they show compared to what you have. You want to investigate that. Don't let this go. All right. I hope that answered your question. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810, and you can talk live on air with me or off air. I do have some questions that have come into the office just in general today. And as I was mentioning at the top of the show before the call started coming in, which I love, just keep, you know, that's okay. I love the questions. I was starting to mention that I had some clients who had received some literature or gone to a seminar about transferring a house to their child tax-free. And what I caution them about is you have to be careful when you go to seminars. You have to be careful when you get this literature in the mail where you have either insurance people, financial advisors, banks, lawyers, whomever, saying things like, oh, do this great thing, tax-free, you're going to save money. You want to be careful. Approach with caution, because generally if you're getting solicitations in the mail, it could mean that that person who's sending that to you has something to gain from sending you that information. Maybe they want you to come to, you know, one of those seminars where the lawyers charge you $2,500 to put together documents, or maybe they want to get you into some kind of an annuity. So you've got to be careful, because transferring a house to your child, if it's your principal residence, tax-free, what does that mean? Again, I said, whether it's estate tax, inheritance tax, or income tax, you heard earlier me talking to John about a house. If you own a principal residence and you've lived and owned it two out of the last 5 years, if you're married filing joint, you save $500,000, you know, in gains. So it's not like if you had that house and you were going to sell it, or rush to sell it to do something income tax free. If you want to live there till you die, you can do that. And transfer the house at a stepped up basis through your estate. Some people try to do that in Pennsylvania, but then you might run into an inheritance tax problem or a capital gains tax problem. That's what I meant, capital gains tax problem. If you transfer a house that's not a child's principal residence and then they go to sell it, they have capital gains on it because it wasn't their principal residence. So there's so many issues around these things. You want to be careful. I had another question come in, which I'll answer after this next break. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
And you are listening to WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station, your source for NPR news, public affairs, and a great mix of hand-picked music. Lehigh Valley weather, current conditions, 63 degrees under fair skies. Tonight, chance of showers, lows around 41. Thursday, sunny and breezy, highs around 46. Friday, chance of snow, highs around 39. Saturday and Sunday, sunny skies with lows in the 20s. Folks, the time now is 6:31. Now back to your financial choices with our host, Lori Siebert.
Thank you, Jeff. We had a caller call in to let us know that the IRS office in Bethlehem is still there, but it's appointment only. They're no longer allow walk-ins, so appointment only. Caller, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. I love that. Educating the audience, that's what we love. So I appreciate that. We also had Tatiana call in from Allentown, and she asked how long should she keep tax returns. You can get very different answers, Tatiana, but basically you'd want to keep at least 6 years. The 6-year rule is because of the IRS could come back and say there's a problem, which normally they can only go back 3 years. But if they think there is, I believe, negligence, it's either negligence or fraud. One of them they can go back 6 years and the other one they can go back indefinitely. So what I tell folks, I frankly have all my tax returns, but what I tell folks is if there is some other element on your tax return that was generated or initiated or reported many, many years ago that still is impacting your tax return today, you want to keep all of those tax returns. What I'm talking about is if you sold, let's say, a stock 20 years ago that generated a $100,000 loss in my example, and you're carrying that capital loss forward every single year for 20 years, and the IRS decides to audit you today, they can say, hey, Tatiana, you have this capital loss carryover. Where did this come from? And you say, hey, IRS, 20 years ago, I sold that stock for a $100,000 loss. They might say, hey, let's see it. So that's why sometimes I want people to keep tax returns from way back. So let's pretend you have a very basic tax return, W-2, and like that's it. Well, you're probably okay to maybe get rid of tax returns after 6 years. Why some people might want to hold on to tax returns is another reason would be when you go to apply for Social Security, if you ever know, not apply for Social Security, if you ever want to know what your Social Security benefit will be, you can request your Social Security illustration or statement. I forget what they call it. And it's always a good idea to kind of eyeball what they're reporting as your wages. So that might be another reason. You can sign up for on Social Security's website, ssa.gov. You can sign up for an account. It's called My Account with confidential information. And then you can see what your Social Security history is. Let's say you're very have simple wages. You could go in, eyeball them. If they all look accurate, you don't need your tax returns for any other reason, then you can shred those ones from prior to 6 years. Long answer, but I hope that helped. And I hope it helped more than just you, because a lot of people ask that question, Tatiana. So that was a great question. We have Corrick in Coopersburg. He asked, or she, if you sell a home to children at a low amount, do they pay inheritance tax? If so, on which amount? The given cost or actual worth of home? Okay, so this ties into that other question that I had earlier from my clients. I guess what I want to know is, why are you selling your home to your children? So let me give you some real quick basics. In Pennsylvania, if you are a resident of Pennsylvania and you die, your assets are reported, any assets that you can controlled or owned are reported on an inheritance tax return. They're subject to inheritance tax based on the relationship to whom you're transferring assets. So let's pretend you're transferring your house to your child. And let's say your house is worth $100,000. At a 4.5% tax rate, that's the rate to pass to children, 4.5% tax rate, you're passing that house to your child. It's $4,500 of inheritance tax. There's discounts for paying earlier, and that's what it is. But let's say instead you say, well, gosh, I want to avoid that inheritance tax. By golly, I'm going to be smart, and I'm going to transfer this house to my child while I'm alive, and then they won't have the inheritance tax. So you're living along, you're in your house, but you transferred it to your kid. They own it, but you're still living in it. What you have transferred to them is a house with whatever value it is today, but at your cost basis, your acquisition. So if you paid $20,000 for that house, yes, you can transfer it to your child. The transfer is a $100,000 transfer. There's no gift tax if your estate's under $5.5 million, basically. The IRS lets us transfer $14,000 a year to anybody we want. We have a lifetime exclusion of about $5,490,000. We might have to file a gift tax return if the gift's more than $14,000, but we don't have any gift tax at this point. So yes, we can transfer the $100,000 to our child and not have any gift tax, income tax, inheritance tax at this point. So we've in my story, I'm transferring. I'm not selling yet, okay? So I transfer the house. But now my child has my cost basis. So even though I transferred the value of $100,000, they by virtue of that gift, they take on my cost basis and my holding period. If my child doesn't live there, then they don't qualify for the principal residence exclusion because they have to live there and own it too out of the last 5 years. So my child doesn't live there in my example, and now you die and they decide to sell it. And they sell it, let's say, for $100,000. Their cost basis is $20,000. They have an $80,000 gain, subject to 15% possibly capital gains tax. Could be zero, could be 20. In my example, it's going to be 15% capital gains tax and subject to state tax as well. So was that such a smart idea to transfer it to my child when I might be faced with capital gains tax? Now, if your child lives there and it's going to be their principal residence too, that might be good planning. But these are the kinds of questions and strategies you want to talk to an attorney about to make sure you're doing everything the right way. Now, you had asked, what if you sold the home to the child at a low amount? You're asking, do they pay inheritance tax? As long as you survive any kind of transfer, you know, beyond a year, then if you were to transfer the house and you survive a year, it's out of your estate, but then it's subject to those capital gains. In the case where you're selling it, there wouldn't be an inheritance tax, except that if you sell it at a low amount, meaning you're selling it at less than fair market value, then there's an element of gift in that sale price. So if the house is worth $100,000 and you decide to sell it to your child for $40,000, then obviously there's an element of gifting in there. And then we're back to kind of those gift rules where under, you know, $14,000, over 14, you file gift tax return, no gift tax, blah, blah, blah. But now your child's basis would be the $100,000, because the basis, I think, would be, well, what they paid for it plus the cost basis that you had. So there would be some element of your cost basis and the price that they have paid. If you survive a year, then that shouldn't come back in. But there is an element of gifting in a transaction that you're selling for less than fair market value as well. And then we're back to whether they, if it's their principal residence or not, if they eventually sell it, if it would actually be excluded. So you really want to think that through. I tell you, the clients I was talking to earlier today about this, though, they had a great plan. And I thought this was really, really smart. So they live in Illinois. They have a home. And what they did is they paid, I think it's a deposit at like a senior living center. I think it was only maybe $1,500 to have their name put on a list that when an apartment becomes available in the senior center, they get called. They don't have to accept that apartment and they can stay on the list. They did it in case it would eventually come to the point where they felt they couldn't take care of their home any longer. And I thought that was a great way to kind of manage that, keeping their principal residence, having the option to move into a senior living center by having this deposit at such time they would find it, you know, convenient or more apt for them to be in that center. And at that point, you know, imagine they would still be alive then. So they have that option. They're still alive. They sell their home. They get the principal residence exclusion, no income tax. They take the proceeds from the sale of their home. They put it into a brokerage account, maybe invest the money or maybe, you know, buy a nicer apartment, but invest that money. And if they invest it like in an individual or joint account, any appreciation, if they still hold those assets when they die, that gets a step up in basis. And guess what? Their heirs then wouldn't have capital gains tax if they sold it like the next day, because they get a step up in basis to what they paid for it up to the date of death value. So lots of things to talk about. You know, I just want to mention, I wrote an article today for, I'm a column coordinator for the Pennsylvania Institute of Certified Public Accountants, the PICPA CPA Journal. So I write some columns and articles for the PICPA Journal. And I just put one in today for personal financial planning. And I emphasize the word personal, because so often today you hear people talk about financial planning or having financial advisors or having financial planners or using financial planning tools, online tools. Everybody has them. You have a number, you have a score, you have a confidence level, statistics. But you know what? People have forgotten the personal part of it. The personal part is your situation. What makes a difference for you? Who are the kids? What kids do you have? Are you confident in, you know, what they might inherit? Are you confident in your own situation? What is your situation? What state are you from? Do you need to sell your home? Do you think that's a good idea? So let's not forget about the personal situation when we're doing planning. It could make all the difference. Folks, if you have questions tonight, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We're doing tax questions in particular tonight. I love the calls. I love the questions. They've been great, make such a difference, and it's so much fun for me to be able to answer these questions. I do have a whole slew of questions that folks asked me today. Real quick before we take our next break, I had someone tell me that they received a combined 1099-G, G as in George, and a filing requirement notification. It was from the Delaware Department of Revenue. This person happens to be a Delaware resident. And she said it shows that she has a refund. Does she owe tax on her refund? Well, a couple things there. 1099-G, G as in George, is actually G as in government. So whenever you receive a 1099-G, it means that you must have had a refund from your state or local taxing authority in the prior year. So in 2016, you might have received a refund from your 2015 tax return. Whether or not it's taxable depends on whether or not you got a benefit from deducting income taxes on your return. You would only benefit from deducting income taxes on your return, number one, if you itemize deductions. So if you didn't itemize deductions, those refunds aren't going to be taxable to you. If you itemize deductions, then there's a little worksheet you need to do to see if it actually would be taxable, because you have to consider how much of a benefit you actually received from deducting those taxes. So a refund may or may not be income taxable, but for sure, if you didn't itemize, it would not be taxable. So you want to watch for that, especially for those people who self-prepare their returns. All right, folks, we're taking our last break. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. If you have questions, in particular tax questions tonight, the phone number is 610-758-8810. 610-758-8810. We take questions live on air or off air, whatever you're more comfortable doing. And I will mention that I'm actually going to take listeners' questions next week as well. So if you were a little shy this week, next week is another chance. I'm also going to talk about Schedule D transactions next week, which are the sales of, sales of like stock and mutual funds, bonds, things like that. So I'll talk about Schedule D next week as well as taking listeners' questions next week. So again, 610-758-8810. Lydia from Bethlehem called and asked, when I was first separated from my husband, the first tax filing, I had to pay around $5,000 while my husband, received a large refund. I was told I had to file like him. What does that mean? What happened? So when you are separated from a spouse, you have the option of filing jointly or married filing separately. Generally, it is better to file married filing jointly. And when I have spouses who are separating that are still at least amicable with each other, if it is better to file jointly, I would usually suggest this. Each partner in the marriage gets a copy of the tax return, so you both know what you're signing, but filing joint is typically a better. And then we can actually do calculations and figure out maybe what share of any refund or tax due would be to each person, or somehow make a fair allocation of that refund or tax due. What happens, though, when you file separately, you have to file the same way as far as your deduction. So either you're filing standard deduction or you're filing itemized deductions. If one does itemize, you both have to do itemized, and that's where you probably got hurt. If they itemized and took a bunch of deductions and you didn't have those same kinds of deductions, that could be why you ended up owing more. I'm not sure. But the married filing separate is not always the best. We have a caller on line one. We have Tatiana back. Tatiana, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
Good. How can I help you?
Well, I have heard through the grapevine that if you're single mm-hmm. versus if you're married and you file married, joint, I guess, mm-hmm. There's a benefit to filing joint compared to filing single. And I wanted to know if that's true or if it's just a rumor.
Well, if you are actually, when you say single, or do you mean married filing separate?
No, just single.
Okay, so let's pretend you're in a relationship, a long-term relationship. You're both single. You both have your own income. And you wonder, gosh, if we got married, would it be a better deal? Or is it the same? There was at one time what we called the marriage penalty, so that when folks who were single and paid their taxes separately, and then all of a sudden they get married, they were paying more taxes. They tried to eliminate that with the tax brackets and the tax code in some regard with the, so for example, married filing joint, the 10% tax bracket is up till $18,000 and the single tax bracket is like $9,000. So they tried to kind of, I think, manage that a little bit. I think where people get caught off, and I don't know if you heard the beginning of the show, someone had called in and they were talking about all of a sudden they owed so much money. What happens is when you're married and you do put your money together, sometimes the withholdings get off. So if the IRS has attempted to kind of equalize married people with single people, where we get off is because of our withholdings. Because if I'm single, it looks like a much lower rate. But then if we're married and we put it together, sometimes it kind of throws it off a little bit. So I haven't done like any recent analysis of it. But generally, if you're married, people will sometimes ask, is it better for us to file separately? And for the most part, that is not as good of a filing status. So if you are thinking about getting married, you're in a partnership, I would probably run numbers if you care to be married and think that might be a deal breaker. You could run numbers. Okay?
Okay.
All right. I hope that helps. Good luck. Thanks for calling in. Yeah, years ago, there was something that they called the marriage penalty, but they did try to kind of plan for that a little bit. Where I think people also get kind of off is when there's different filing statuses and then with exemptions with kids and sometimes the withholding gets off for that as well. I know that some of the tax proposals that are getting floated out there, they are trying to make the standard deduction much, much higher and eliminate exemptions. The standard deduction that they're looking at for single people would be $15,000. And right now, I think the standard deduction for single people is $6,300. And they're going to make it $15,000, but they're going to eliminate the exemption. And the exemption is, oh gosh, what's the exemption? About $4,050. So if you're single, $6,300 plus $4,050, you're looking at $10,350. They're looking at raising the standard deduction to $15,000. That sounds, oh wow, like that could be a good deal for you. And in some cases it could, but they're also looking at changing the tax brackets, how much money is in those tax brackets. So we are yet to see what will happen with that. Folks, we probably have time for one more question if people would like to. The phone number is 610-758-8810. The other question I had today, someone said they had a reminder about a 2016 tax return. Again, this Delaware person said, my Delaware return is due May 1st. They encourage electronic filing. Didn't you file my return? Well, I reminded the person it's the 2016 tax return the notice was about. And the 2016 tax returns, we're not done yet. We haven't finished them. They're due April 18th this year. I also had a question that said, I understand putting my IRAs into my trust will force my heirs to withdraw and it will be a taxable event for them. This is the reason I prefer a stretch IRA with named beneficiaries so it can be left to the heirs if they wish. If in trust, there will be high fees and costs. Do you agree? Well, there was a lot in that question as well. And I will mention that I often caution people about putting retirement accounts in trust. You have to be very careful with that. You want to work with a good attorney who knows what language to put in that trust document if you happen to have any retirement benefits going into a trust. And in fact, sometimes they will automatically put some special language in those trusts in case any retirement accounts end up going in trust. So I do prefer if your beneficiaries can handle it, if you name individual beneficiaries, because they can stretch it out over their life expectancy. Sometimes if you name a trust, it could kind of muck that up a little bit and cause some acceleration or cause the stretch to be over the oldest person's age. So you just want to be careful with that. But I have another call coming in, so I'm going to defer answering any further on that other question. We have Josh in Macungie. Josh, can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hi, how can I help you?
My question is, for work, I'm a traveling musician, and I keep all my receipts of all the food that I consume while I'm traveling.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if it's possible, if you know the percentage of price that I can claim, you know, as a business expense at the end of the year. I was wondering if you could help me out with that.
Well, I think what happens is anyone, I think when they're traveling, if I go to work and I'm an employee and I go out to eat, I don't get to deduct that because, you know, your meals are just part of your day. What you're saying is you are traveling. There are, you can keep your receipts.
Sure.
And there's a difference between, I think, meals and entertainment. Let me just, I just pulled up in my book here because I wanted to be sure on some of this. Enter deductible business meals and entertainment expenses, including meals while traveling away from home. And there's a per diem amount. Instead of using actual expenses for meals and incidental expenses, per diem amounts up to the IRS approved per diem rates may be deducted. So a per diem says, depending on what city you're in or town you're in, you may be able to just say, maybe in New York, the per diem rate for the day is $50 for food or $40. You can choose to do the per diem rate or use your actual expenses. And the and then there's a limitation of 50%. So in general, a deduction for business meals and entertainment is limited to 50% of actual cost. When the per diem rate is used in place of actual expenses, the deduction is reduced by 50% of the per diem meal amount. So you're looking typically at 50%. That's for federal purposes, though,
sure,
Josh.
Sure.
For Pennsylvania, we get to deduct them 100%. So you have to be careful. If you're doing it in software, it might do it automatically for you. If you're doing a longhand version, you want to make sure you take the full deduction. But there's no cap that I'm aware of. Now, granted, if you make $1,000 as your traveling musician and you have $5,000 of meal expenses, eventually they might try to cap you by telling you can't do this anymore.
Sure.
There are certain occupations that lend themselves to what we call the hobby loss rules, and the IRS wants to see people making a profit. And so that would be my only other caution. But otherwise, it's not like you can only take $5. It's that 50% limitation that you maybe might have been looking for.
That's wonderful.
Okay.
That helps a lot.
Okay.
Thank
keep
you.
Your receipts and remember your mileage as well, Josh. You keep
will
track
do.
Of your miles.
Yeah, always.
Okay. Great. Good job.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks for calling in.
Okay. Take care.
Okay. Bye bye. It's been a great show tonight. I just love these questions, and I love that I get challenged. It's, I have to remember all the details of all these little pieces that. When you use software all the time, sometimes you just have to enter the information. I knew about the 50% limitation, but I wanted to check on that per diem part. I rarely see people using per diem except for pilots. I've seen pilots and Air Force, military people using more per diem. I also want to mention, if you are self-employed, folks, don't spend money just to lower your taxes. You in the end, you do not necessarily net out better. try to be thrifty and not to spend too much as a self-employed person. I had one guy buy tons of computers so he could expense them and not have pay taxes, but that made no sense because he was spending all that money he didn't need to spend. All right. So I mentioned next week we're having more listeners' questions and also understanding merger, spinoff, splits, and Schedule D reporting. We've seen a lot of that around here for people who had talent and PPL. So I thought I would go over some of that. I want to thank Lori for being here, Jeff for being here, listeners especially. Thanks so much for calling in. I really appreciate it. I love the live calls as well. We'll do that again next week. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices, and have a great week.